But I used to think that I was doomed to die young, to be consumed. Our lullabies were violent, those winters of my discontent.
Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Sarah LaDuke, in for Joe Donahue this morning. I mightn't volunteer this information, but he has been, so I feel empowered to do so. He is having his surgery today. We all wish him well. We hope that the after is impossibly better than the prior, and that he has a magical turnaround and feels just 100% better very soon. So Joe is out today, likely to end tomorrow, maybe Thursday, but he'll be back soon. And I will fill in. David Gustina's hosting the show tomorrow, and then I'll probably be back Thursday. But anyway, you'll see, you'll hear. We'll be here, and we will keep doing the show, of course. But we are wishing Joe a safe surgery and a quick recovery. The music this morning is by Allison Russell from her album The Returner. She is playing a concert for the O Positive Festival. It is a fundraising concert for their year-round clinic in Kingston, New York. The concert is on May 24th. You can learn more by visiting opositivefestival.org. And I'm going to tell you that Allison Russell is it. Keep an eye out. She's huge. She's marvelous. She's associated with wonderful acts that we all love that are bringing her up and bringing her around, and she's absolutely marvelous. So she's playing a concert at the intimate and glorious venue of the Old Dutch Church. And it might be the last time you could see her in such a small space. So I would advise, if you're interested, checking that out. That is opositivefestival.org, the musician Allison Russell, and she will be providing our music beds this morning. The playlist is posted online at wamc.org/roundtable. You can join the conversation by emailing panel@wamc.org. And who will you be conversing with, should you email today? The following people: Ulster County Comptroller and former president and CEO of the Community Foundations of the Hudson Valley, March Gallagher. Good morning, March. How are you?
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
Of course.
And happy Passover to those who celebrate,
Thank
including
you.
Myself.
Thank you. Semi-retired editor-at-large, columnist, editorial writer of the Times Union, Jay Jochnowitz. Good morning, Jay.
Good morning, and happy Passover. Over to, and I hope I join you in your get well soon wishes for Joe.
Of course. And the Empire Report's JP Miller, our just about every other Tuesday panelist. How's it going, JP?
It's going great, and I too am thinking about our good friend Joe and hope that there's no place worse than, I guess there are worse places than a hospital, but it's no fun to be in there, and I hope he does really great.
Yeah.
I'm thinking about him.
We're all sending him, the vibes.
Vibes.
Once again, panel@wamc.org to join the conversation. Before we begin, speaking of the stories we've selected, I did want to ask you, March, if there's anything in the Hudson Valley you want us to know about.
Well, I think it's interesting you're talking about O Positive, which is just a fabulous festival. Everybody should check it out. It's a multi-day event in October, and it really brings the community together where you have artists exchanging art for healthcare, and you have health practitioners serving the community. So it's a really exciting event. And the Hudson Valley is just a beautiful place to be. So come down and visit us if you haven't already.
Panel@wamc.org. Let's begin this morning with an update on the college protests. This is from the AP. Columbia canceled in-person classes. Dozens of protesters were arrested at New York University and Yale. And the gates to Harvard Yard were closed to the public Monday as some of the most prestigious U.S. universities sought to defuse campus tension over Israel's war with Hamas. More than 100 pro-ceasefire or pro-Palestinian demonstrators who had camped out on Columbia's green were arrested last week. And similar encampments have sprouted up at universities around the country as schools struggle with where to draw the line between allowing free expression while maintaining safe and inclusive campuses. At New York University, an encampment set up by students swelled to hundreds of protesters throughout the day yesterday. The school said it warned the crowd to leave and then called the police after the scene became disorderly, and the university said it learned of reports of intimidating chants and several anti-Semitic incidents. Shortly after 8:30 p.m., officers began making arrests. The protests have pitted students against one another, with pro-Palestinian students demanding that their schools condemn Israel's assault on Gaza and divest from companies that sell weapons to Israel. Some students, Jewish students, meanwhile, say much of the criticism of Israel has veered into anti-Semitism and made them feel unsafe. They point out that Hamas is still holding hostages taken during the group's October 7th invasion. Jay.
There is so much to unpack with this that I won't try to do it in one breath or one sentence. But the phrase that keeps going on around in my head is that it really is possible for two things to be true. And every step of the way, when I look at the issues in the demonstrations and the wider issue of Israel and Gaza, that there are just so many truisms there that it is possible for Hamas to be wrong, and it is also possible for the Israeli government to be wrong. It is possible to be critical of the Israeli government and also not be anti-Semitic. It's possible to believe in a two-state solution and also to recognize that it's a very difficult, not impossible, but certainly impractical thing to achieve now. And it's also possible to say that there are things that have gotten out of hand on some of the campuses, and that and it's also possible to say that it is that the demonstrations are overall justified. And I think the participation of Jewish students in those demonstrations is a testament to that. That these are not inherently anti-Semitic demonstrations. They are demonstrations that are critical of Israel and in support of people who are suffering in Palestine. Or in Gaza, and there is a failure of leadership here. I think that's the other thing that really really occurs to me, is that I think the Columbia's president helped precipitate this, along with Elise Stefanik and some of the other people on the committee, by caving to the idea that basically she went into Congress to appease Congress and please her interrogators, her inquisitors, who have turned this, as I wrote the editorial in the Times Union today, who have turned this into an almost McCarthy-esque situation where they're calling people in to basically, this is an anti-sympathy for Palestinians crusade that they're on, and an anti Ivy League schools, which Elise Stefanik has a big vendetta with. I'll stop there because I've already started unpacking a whole lot more, and now the bed's a mess.
It's okay. It's all right. We will keep, moving things around, because I don't think we're going to get it all tidied up on the show today, March.
I mean, certainly arresting the protesters at Columbia has made things more difficult, more challenging. I do not think that it's sent the message that the president or the Board of Trustees wanted. She did not consult the Senate, which is the academic body that governs, that includes faculty. And I think that was a huge mistake, because there's no buy-in from faculty in general. And I also have a lot of concerns for those students who do feel like they're at risk at the university. I understand there are Jewish students protesting as well. But a question I have, and something that I've been spending time thinking about, is what the actual ask is here, which is to have Columbia University divest. And as somebody who was very active in trying to get RPI to divest from South Africa in, the 1980s, it's really on my mind that investment strategies are different now. And it's really hard to get what you want out of this because of the ETF market. We don't necessarily have these companies holding, these endowments holding specific stocks in the same way. They could be holding index funds, and it's just a lot more challenging. So the ask is really, in a way, to me, somewhat performative. And they're using the divestment argument to get out on the street and protest, which is fine at the end of the day, right? That's people's right. But I also just, I want to note, we had a significant protest outside the county office building with tents and with 100 people outside my office window chanting "From the River to the Sea." And I felt scared to walk outside. Not that I thought somebody was going to attack me, but I did feel like the people that I knew in that crowd, and I knew a lot of them, were going to insist that I give a statement or take a position that I was not ready to take. So I understand students who will feel concerned.
JP?
Yeah, it is. It is obviously very complex. I think that the fact that the media is now focused so so much on it is attracting a lot of non-students, I think, to the protests. And anytime that there are non-students on campus, that, I think, poses a big problem for administrators. There's also, you know, Governor Kathy Hochul, Senator Gillibrand, Mayor Eric Adams, all of these elected officials came out yesterday and denounced the hateful, vile, a lot of the hateful and vile statements that were being made by a lot of the protesters. Not all the protesters, but there were those statements being made. And, you know, at the end of the day, our educational institutions, I think, are places for kids to go and learn and certainly to feel safe. And when you've got Jewish students that feel unsafe, it's a bad place for a university to be. The president of the university has a really tough job, has a lot of constituencies. And I couldn't imagine being in her shoes trying to make these decisions. I also, there are a lot of protests in New York throughout the year, whether it be on Israel-Palestine or other issues. And I think, I could be wrong, but I think sometimes protesters like to be arrested, right?
Oh, sure.
That's part of the gig. They like it. Another thing is, which hasn't been talked about, and I say this a little bit in jest, but I talked to someone older than me who's very close to me. I said, well, what do you think about the protests? And he said, well, you're not old enough to remember Vietnam, but around Vietnam, they would always protest around finals time. And maybe that was a little bit said in jest, but I'm surprised that it's now moved on to NYU, and another 100 people or 120 plus were arrested at NYU. And you do kind of wonder, why don't they protest on somewhere other than a university campus so that kids can go to school and they could protest somewhere else, the Brooklyn Bridge or somewhere else?
Jay?
One thing that I left out of my stuff was the one hopeful and happy story that I read about this was the Seder, which was kind of interfaith. It sounded like both Jewish students as well as Muslim and Christian, and everybody kind of gathered around these makeshift, quote-unquote, Seder tables, sheets that had been painted and so forth. It was a really heartwarming thing to read, and I think it spoke to the reality of these protests, the broader reality that this is a very mixed group of people, that you've got Jewish Voice for Peace, which has been, you know, sharply at odds with the more militant stance that Israel takes and has long been. I met with them years ago when they first started really pushing for a two-state solution. And it's a very cogent argument that they make. It's you know, when you sit down, it's like, why not? You know, why can't this work? And, you know, and they've thought about the militarism and they've thought about, you know, both states living in security and so forth. But the Seder story just warmed my heart. I just wanted to mention
it
that.
It didn't warm my heart.
It didn't.
No. I don't know why. I thought it would sort of when I started with the headline. I was like, oh, that's kind of... And then I was like, you know what? This feels like a way to provide an assurance to Jewish students and Americans that may not be real. The bottom line is if you're in a crowd and you feel like people are pushing back at you, it's scary and no Seder... you know, table is going to change that. For me, I don't know, you know, maybe other students would have taken away a more safe message from that. But I don't begrudge that. On the other hand, like, it was Passover, and if people want to protest and have their Seder in the protest, then they're certainly welcome to do so. But I did not come away with the warm feeling that you came away with, Jay.
Interesting. You know, one of the reasons I came away with a warm feeling was that, you know, I grew up in a conservative Jewish household. And by conservative, I mean the sect, not the... not the political views. And it was a pretty... For a lot of my childhood, pretty isolated. So Seders were about Jews. And then all of a sudden, language started to come into the Seder as I got older that there was an expression that of a feeling that we should sympathize with all people who are living under oppression. And that was a unusual concept. It was like, so, you know, these people and those people and those people, those are all outsiders as far as, you know, I was concerned as a child in this very insulated bubble that I was in. And if you're going to live that truth, then you really have to live it. And that's why I liked the idea. You know, you could say it's cultural appropriation. You could say that, you know, it's hijacking the Seder for a political statement. It's false assurance. I think it's potentially all those things, depending on
all those things. I mean, I have to agree. I was raised by a totally secular family, non-religious, but culturally we celebrated Passover. We have like a hippie Haggadah. You know, I grew up in Woodstock. You know, there is no God is not a man in there. You know, and it does not say, you know, next year in Jerusalem. That is not part of our what we say. And there is an acknowledgement of all oppressed people in sort of our ceremony and what we're looking at. So. I appreciate and respect that piece of it. And I agree. I think it's very hard to kind of walk through the thoughts about what Passover means and not think about everyone who is in a really dire circumstance and oppression of all peoples. So,
panel at WAMC.org to join the conversation. The panel this morning, Ulster County Comptroller and former president and CEO of the Community Foundations of the Hudson Valley, March Gallagher. Semi-retired editor-at-large, columnist, editorial writer for the Times Union, Jay Jochnowitz, and the Empire Report's J.P. Miller. This is the Roundtable panel. Once again, you can join the conversation by emailing us at panel@wamc.org, and we will return with more after news from the BBC. I'm a sad child again. Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Sarah LaDuke. Our music this morning by Allison Russell from her album The Returner. She's playing a concert for O Positive in Kingston, New York on May 24th at the Old Dutch Church in Kingston. It's opositivefestival.org. The panel this morning, March Gallagher, Jay Jochnowitz, and J.P. Miller. You can join the conversation by emailing panel@wamc.org. We have a couple of letters on our previous topic, which was the protests at regional American universities about the war in the Middle East. Let us start with this one. Matt says, of course, NYU called the police on their students and faculty. NYU has partnered with the authoritarian regimes around the world, including UAE and PRC, to establish a global network of civil rights oppression. That's from Matt. Any response?
I haven't been to NYU in a few years. It's been quite a few years. My son spent a semester there. And my son is a pretty liberal guy. And even he was having a hard time with the orthodoxy at NYU and ended up saying, I need a more real-world situation to get my college education. Ended up going to Brooklyn College.
Okay.
And was very happy there. He really thrived there. I don't know about the administration of NYU, but the environment at NYU is hardly a corporate capitalist regime. You would get that sense there.
Okay. March?
I don't know what the reader speaks of. I'm going to have to research that a little bit. I'd like to know a little bit more about NYU's politics. I don't really have a clear picture on it. I think it's interesting that, you know, there are protests coast to coast, you know, or at least on the coast. And we're seeing, you know, multiple colleges involved. And, you know, that just speaks, I think, to the sentiment of college age Americans right now and how frustrated they are and how pervasive it is. And I've also seen commentary that, you know, there are colleges in the middle of the country that are seeing nothing. So that makes me wonder.
The reader does bring up an interesting point, which we haven't mentioned yet, which is, you know, for instance, the Columbia president, how much do donors influence what the president's actions are when, you know, billionaires call up, like Robert Kraft, the owner of the Patriots, and other billionaires call up who give tens of millions of dollars a year. I think they were instrumental. Donors were instrumental in having the Harvard president removed. Mm-hmm. And that is a constituency that the president certainly takes into account. And how much are those discussions influencing the presidents of NYU and Columbia and Yale, and you know, that's a lot of what I think college presidents do is raise money from wealthy donors. That's a big part of their job.
And that's why it was so concerning that the Columbia president did not go to the Senate you know, the Senate body of the academic institution, because they are supposed to be consulted prior to an invitation. The executive committee is supposed to be consulted prior to the invitation of law enforcement onto campus. So that's a big change. And it does feel pressured by donors. I'm sure they're all feeling the heat of potentially losing, you know, funds from people of all sides, right? Both sides of concern. So they're not necessarily being driven by academic freedom, freedom of speech, and what faculty on campus and students on campus think is the best way to go.
Chris writes in and says, in all fairness to Vietnam protesters, this response to something JP shared, the spring timing of the protest had more to do with weather than exams. Also, the most pervasive protests were in reaction to the Kent State killings of student protesters, which happened to take place during the spring of 1970. It was not because of a desire to get out of finals. When I was in school in Boston, there were quite a few Vietnam protests in the fall when students arrived back on campus.
You know, I think that speaks to another issue here, that some of the protests that have started, from what I've read, are not have started since the arrests started. It are not protests about Gaza; they're protests about the arrests
And freedom of speech and expression, you know, and right to assemble.
So the snowballing effect of Kent State was kind of people identifying with other students, and I think we're going to see that here as well. And I think it really calls. It really puts the spotlight on the need for people in leadership positions, from whether it's college presidents, whether it's the NYPD, whether it's our good folks in Congress, to really cool it down. They it needs to start with them, unfortunately I don't think it's going to.
I have to agree with that, and I also have to say I'm now concerned about the safety of protesters. Like, I am terrified that we're going to see a student or protester who's just affiliated with the university injured or hurt, and that's going to make things blow up and it's going to get worse. I'm not sure, like, when you weigh the health and safety of protesters versus the health and safety of Jewish students on campus feeling unsafe, where we lie, where do we come out, what's that balance? And we may be seeing, things taken too far, I think, with these mass arrests. I just can't picture that mass arrest is the right answer to this problem.
E writes in and says, students at Columbia are asking for Columbia to be transparent with their investment portfolio. The Columbia administration refuses. That is the student request. I'm trying to get their emphasis. Columbia could release this information to end the protest, but they refuse. They are complicit in continuing the protest, and they have no intent in ever listening to students' requests for transparency in their business.
I agree. They have like a special investment management company, Columbia does. It's really impenetrable. I did try to get more information. It's something that I've spent a lot of time thinking about. So I was like, let me look at this. So I agree with that caller and writer that it really is a black box.
Why is it secret?
I don't have the answer to that. I don't know the answer.
Are all the universities, you think, their endowments secret?
No, I don't. I think that there's an effort to make it less visible because of things like this. And I also think the function of investing in structures and investment vehicles like index funds make it very, very hard to tell. It's a changing and ever-shifting portfolio, right? If you're in an index fund, what's in that index fund might change during the day.
You would also think, though, that you're an institution of higher learning. You're a huge nonprofit, an iconic foundational nonprofit to the country. And you would think that having transparency on their investments would not be an issue, right? I don't know why they wouldn't share that. I understand investment managers not wanting to give their holdings out because they're private. It's their money or their shareholders' money. That's a different thing than a public institution like an Ivy League university.
I'm saying that the way that they're invested and the types of vehicles that they're invested in make it hard to track the investments from day to day. I'm not saying it's impossible, but you have a shifting landscape a little bit, so it's hard to make it clear. And I know in Ulster County we had protests. They were protesting a contract, a small $50,000 contract with a company that was owned by BlackRock under the point that, Ulster County is doing business with BlackRock. It was a public safety software contract. And, BlackRock does have ownership of companies that are doing business in Israel. So it's tangential, but legitimate, but it is tangential.
And they could, though. They could list, not every day, but quarterly, they could put out a report. We are invested in these 50 private equity funds. We are invested in these 25 ETFs. We're invested, you know, these real estate companies. I mean, it wouldn't be hard for them to release the quarterly information. The problem for them, I guess, the university is that each one of those holdings is going to be problematic somehow. In terms of, oh, it's this private equity manager who is a Trump supporter, or this ETF holds, you know, firearms companies, or
$13.64 billion. If anybody's wondering about the Columbia endowment size, $13 billion. Doesn't sound that big, actually, when you think about
$13 doesn't, but billion does.
I mean,
I would have thought a lot more.
I would have thought a lot more. Yeah. Yeah.
They need to start fundraising better.
Who doesn't?
Good luck with that right now.
Panel at WAMC.org to join the conversation. Let us take our next underwriting break a little bit early since we will begin a new topic. We'll be right back. Every cut, every kiss, I'll wear. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel. I'm Sarah LeDuc here with March Gallagher, Jay Jochnowitz, and J.P. Miller. You can join the conversation by emailing panel at WAMC.org. Again, our bumper music this morning is by Allison Russell. She's playing a fundraising concert for the O Positive Festival in Kingston, New York on May 25th to help fund their year-round health clinic. OPositiveFestival.org for more information, and the playlist is posted online at WAMC.org/roundtable. Former President Trump is back in court this morning for the second day after jury selection, the second day of testimony, and we'll do some kind of bullet points of what has happened and what is happening, and then we will talk about it. Trump's attorney used his opening statements to attack the case as baseless yesterday, saying the former president did nothing illegal. This is from the AP. The attorney, Todd Blanche, challenged prosecutors' claims that Trump agreed to pay Daniels to aid his campaign, saying Trump was trying to protect his family, his reputation, and his brand. The attorney indicated the defense will argue that, after all, the very point of a presidential campaign is to try to influence the election. It's called democracy, Blanche told jurors. They put something sinister on this idea, as if it were a crime. You will learn that it's not. Blanche also portrayed the ledger entries at issue in the case as pro forma actions performed by a Trump employee. Former National Enquirer publisher David Pecker is the first witness for the prosecutors, who say that Trump's alleged scheme to conceal potentially damaging information from voters began with a 2015 Trump Tower meeting among the then candidate Pecker and Trump's lawyer Michael Cohen. Pecker's brief turn on the stand Monday was mainly just about his background and other basic facts. He did say the Enquirer practiced checkbook journalism, paying for stories, and that he had the final say on any story about a famous person. He takes the stand again today, or is scheduled to, I should say. Two journalists covering the trial were removed and expelled for breaking rules prohibiting recording and photography in the overflow room. Just another point to add to the conversation. And the presumptive GOP nominee, that of course is former President Donald Trump, will be meeting with former Japanese Prime Minister Taro Aso after court today at Trump Tower. That's according to two people familiar with plans who spoke on condition of anonymity because they had not been formally announced. Several foreign leaders have met with Trump in recent weeks as U.S. allies prepare for the possibility that he could retake the White House. And we have a live update from a few minutes ago from the New York Times saying that prosecutors in Donald J. Trump's criminal trial say he has violated a gag order barring him from attacking witnesses and others close to the case, which centers, we know what the case centers on. The judge is considering holding Trump in contempt of court for verbal attacks. Who would like to begin?
I will. Read that the penalty for each of those violations on the contempt order would be a $1,000 fine, which doesn't sound very much. And also that the judge may not weigh in today. You know, he may just hear arguments and then come back with an opinion later. I also thought it was interesting. This judge was the judge in an earlier criminal case with Trump on the Trump Organization and the nonprofit foundation side. And I didn't realize it was the same judge. I would assume, you know, Donald Trump has a lot of animosity towards this fellow now. And I had to go and look up Clinton's quote unquote, you know, settlement with Paula Jones, because I'm seeing a lot of chatter, particularly in, you know, conservative circles, that, you know, Clinton played hush money too. But hush money is to keep people quiet, and Clinton's case was a settlement of an adjudicated, you know, a court case where the facts were out and were made public. It is not a crime to settle a case or to make a payment. That's not what this case is about, and I think that's the way it's portrayed. This case is really about falsification of business records. And before we get into having people say, well, that's not a big deal, the bottom line is sometimes you're going to be convicted of something that seems like it shouldn't be a big deal. Al Capone was taken down for tax evasion. Was that his biggest crime? No, probably not. So we're all watching, you know, this unfold. And we were joking on the break that Trump is probably jealous about the protests uptown because he's not seeing that outside the courthouse. Yeah.
Jay?
The biggest demonstrations ever. The Clinton thing is a really good point that, in the court of public opinion, we don't like nuance. And nuance is, this is about nuance. The different, and all these cases are, in a sense, that people want to say, well, Biden took home national security documents and Trump took home national security documents. So why aren't you prosecuting Biden, or why are you prosecuting Trump? And you know, Clinton did this, and Hillary did that, and Obama did that. You know, you can go on and on forever. I think that, you know, just listening to the opening arguments and then reading some of the very thoughtful pieces from legal experts who disagree with this trial, it's really interesting what the kind of the nail biter of this for me is whether or not the prosecutors are really going to be able to draw a clear line for the jury to say that's the first thing to explain to them. This is why in this case it was a bad thing. This is more than distasteful. This is more than business as usual in politics. It is this is illegal, and this is why it needs to be punished. I think they have to explain to them. It's not just the law. It's here's why it matters to you.
It's a tenuous argument they're making. It really is, because what they're saying is you falsified business records, and as an element of that claim, right, they're saying, and that was misleading the public on your presidential race.
Right.
And so, you know, there's that extra step. I think it's tenuous to make the argument.
The other half of that is that he's not charged with the crimes that underlie the felonies. And that gets, you know, if you followed, the Joe Bruno case was a good example of that, where it got to the Supreme Court and they said, wait a minute, this honest services business, which is not what this is, but I think it could get tied up in the same kind of argument where they say you needed to prove the other crime too, and you needed to do that. Why didn't you charge him exactly? And they'll say, well, it's not a state crime; it's a federal crime. Maybe that's going to hold some weight. This gets complicated.
We're going to see appeals.
Yeah.
Definitely.
I think we're going to see appeals, and I think we're going to see the public say, what's the big deal? A lot of people, are probably going to say that. And then the question is, what do the jurors end up saying?
JP?
Yeah, you can see why Cy Vance decided not to bring this case when he was the district attorney. And I think that Alvin Bragg in the beginning didn't want to bring it, but may have felt pressured to bring it, and that he might face a Democratic primary if he didn't bring any charges against the former president.
He is in court again today, not expected to attend every day, but is there again today.
And what I agree with what March and Jay said. It is an interesting case in that the facts of the dispute are not really in dispute. It's going to be a question of intent, and Trump's defense is going to be, well, I'm a big businessman. I write checks to people all the time, and it's my staffer's job to figure out how things should be allocated and how things should be done, and. What will be interesting is I think the David Pecker testimony yesterday was basically introduction and background, basically establishing him as a credible witness, where today we will find out what exactly were his conversations with the former president. What did he talk about? Should this be a campaign expense or a personal business expense? How are we going to do this? What was Trump's intent when making this payment? How much did he mention the campaign? And I imagine that they wouldn't bring him up for testimony if he didn't have compelling testimony to give. So it'll be interesting to see exactly what he says today.
I think Michael Cohen's testimony is going to be the linchpin to this case. You know, Pecker, I think, is going to be, you know, the David Pecker and the National Enquirer, the catch and kill was really about a model, not Stormy Daniels, and about a separate doorman at a building who was had an ostensible story that implicated Trump that I think was found to be totally irrelevant or not true. So it's really Cohen's testimony on the Stormy Daniels situation and what Trump's intention was that I think will drive this case. And hopefully the prosecution feels like they have a real case there. I think we're going to see, we'll be finding out. People have noted that he doesn't have a lot of support in the courtroom. You know, family isn't there. That's kind of unusual. Although, you know, he has so many court cases right now. I mean, if I were his family, I'd be like, dude, you're on your own. I mean, I can see that they're just
divide and conquer.
Yeah. Or maybe just like we're not going to these because if we go to one, then it makes a statement about all of them. I think that's a concern. And I was reading some polling on Newsmax. Please don't judge me for that. but a Rasmussen poll that was saying that, you know, 51% of the people polled said Trump cannot get a fair trial in New York. And I think if there's a conviction here, there's going to be a sentiment that Trump wasn't treated fairly, unfortunately, no matter how well orchestrated and how appropriate the rulings are from the bench. So that's a concern.
Panel at WAMC.org to join the conversation. The focus this morning in court does seem to be on the gag order, the prosecution presenting examples from Truth Social posts for reasons that Trump needs to be held in contempt. What do you guys think? Do you think it'll happen?
I
mean, I know it's so just guess.
I get the sense, yes. The judge has little patience for his antics. I think somebody mentioned to me that he took out his cell phone in court at one point, and the judge said something to the lawyers like, tell your client to put that away, you know, that kind of thing. And I think the judge is very clear-headed about and maybe a bit, you know, antagonistic in the sense that I'm not going to let this guy walk all over me and make a mockery out of my courtroom. So he may have a bit of a legal chip, a judicial chip on his shoulder, as a lot of judges do. I mean, they just don't, you know, they don't tolerate nonsense well.
People who don't work in this field, though, I think don't understand why we have these rules in the courtroom. And that's confusing, I think, to people who haven't served on a trial or been involved in a criminal case themselves. Like, why can't he talk? You know, even the words gag order, I think, have a negative connotation. Trump is being chastened. He's not being allowed to talk. How is that a good thing? You know, he should have freedom of speech. So that is an issue right now, just the way it's perceived by regular people and certainly by his supporters. I think the judge's daughter was one of the people that Trump tweets on Truth Social. It's,
we don't know.
What is it?
Posts.
Posts on Truth Social.
I'm not sure.
But yeah, the why have a gag order and what does that mean? And what is the benefit to the rule of law, especially when you have a big contingent of Trump supporters who want to throw out the rule of law, right? We have these rules for a reason. It's so that we reach better judicial outcomes, fairer outcomes, more appropriate outcomes. But we have a bunch of people who don't care about that.
Right. Jonah Brumwich wrote in the Times 7 minutes ago, Conroy, the attorney, is reminding Justice Merchan of the procedural history here, notes that a second order came after Trump ratcheted up attacks on family members that, in personal language, hides something that the judge does know well. Those attacks were made on his own family members, including his daughter.
Scary. I mean, we had another, didn't we have a federal judge, I think Pennsylvania, or whose son was killed a couple of years ago? Yeah. And so, I mean, I think judges' families are at risk in situations like this, not necessarily from the defendant, but from supporters of the defendant and from people, you know, who are angry in the public. So it is, you know, the rules are there for a reason, not just to play a game with Trump.
And that may be one of the few things that, you know, jurists, no matter what their thoughts about this case or anything all around the country, probably agree on, is that they're looking to this judge to make it clear that you can't intimidate them. You can't stir up a mob against a court and expect to just get away with it. And that's what it's about. It's not about free speech.
Right.
Or it's about the limits of free speech, I guess.
One of the things that I think is on trial here is really going to be Trump's demeanor. How does he appear in the courtroom? You know, is that working to his benefit? And I think there's a lot of conversation going on about his appearance, his odor, his, you know, maybe falling asleep in one of the sessions. And it's going to be important, I think, to voters how he handles himself in the courtroom, and whether he has outbursts or not, or violates the rules or not, there are going to be those core supporters who don't care and just want to support him no matter what. And there are going to be people who are offended by his disrespect for the judicial system. And it'll be interesting to see how it plays out and whether or not public opinion turns. I mean, I've seen some recent polling that had Biden up, and I think part of it is because of the behaviors and the outbursts that he's having. So this trial could really push the limit, especially given his prior history with this judge.
JP?
I think he's focused. I think he, of course, wants to win this case, but I think that what his real focus is right now is winning the White House. And when you are in the press and you ask a politician a question about your court case, and the politician says, well, I've been advised by my lawyers not to talk about that topic, that sounds very guilty of the politician. That makes the politician seen in a poor light for a voter. Whereas if Trump is asked and he goes on the attack against the judge and he goes on the attack against it, you wouldn't believe what the judge's daughter said about me. He sees that as helping him with swing voters. He's got, you know, 90% of the country, basically their votes are settled. There are 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10% of the country that are vacillating or going in between Trump and Biden and trying to figure out who to vote for. And he is trying to look like he is the victim in those people's eyes, and that he's not the bad guy. He is the victim. And that was his playbook in 2016, 2020. As president of the United States, he was a victim. And this time in 2024, he's going to play the victim as well. And that's his playbook.
It's been working for him.
It was reported this morning that as he entered the courtroom, he did speak to media, but mostly about topics pertinent to the election and not the trial itself. Hmm. It is time for a break for regional news with Ray Graff. You can join the conversation by emailing panel@wamc.org. Our panelists this morning are March Gallagher, Jay Jochnowitz, and J.P. Miller, and we will return shortly.
Look them in the face. They don't like how sunlight tastes. No, 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 no.
Welcome back to the Roundtable panel. I'm Sarah LaDuc. The music this morning by Allison Russell from her album The Returner. She is playing a concert for the O Positive Festival at the Old Dutch Church in Kingston, New York on May 24th. opositivefestival.org, and the playlist is posted online at wamc.org/roundtable. Today's panelists are Ulster County Comptroller and former president and CEO of the Community Foundations of the Hudson Valley, March Gallagher, semi-retired editor-at-large columnist and editorial writer for the Times Union, Jay Jochnowitz, and The Empire Report's J.P. Miller. We have letters from listeners who wrote into panel@wamc.org, and I will begin with this one from Marie, who says, can Donald Trump's efforts to stir up protests around this election interference trial be used as evidence against him in the DOJ prosecution regarding January 6th?
Can you say that?
Of course I can. Can Trump's efforts to stir up protests around this election interference trial be used as evidence against him in the DOJ prosecution regarding January 6th?
No.
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 No, he's not. I don't think you could charge. I don't think you could bring in something that happens after the crime to somehow enhance the charges in a three-year-old.
A different case, right.
Four-year-old case.
John writes in and says, Trump says he should not be held in contempt of court because he is entitled to free speech. In fact, he wants his speech to be the only speech. He demonstrated that when he was in the White House, not allowing reporters in on conferences and the news coming only from his mouth. And let's see. Joan says, the whole U.S. population understands how respect in the court system works. The endless TV courtroom procedural shows like Law and Order have made that pretty clear. I think that's an interesting point because there are certainly citizens who don't understand the seriousness of the court or don't respect it or don't think it should be so serious because they feel completely victimized by the justice system. So I think there's, you know, factions, as with everything else. Mm-hmm. Jeff writes in and says, it's generally acknowledged that the election will come down to a small group of swing voters. Those who love Trump will not change their minds, nor will those who hate Trump. But regardless of whether you think Trump is the preferable candidate for a swing voter, who wants to sign up for 4 more years of constant turmoil and trouble? This chaos follows him around like Pigpen's dust cloud. It's a Peanuts cartoon reference. Republicans get bent out of shape when Biden fumbles a word or Obama wore a tan suit, but Trump chaos seriously damages the psyche of the nation. And that is from Jeff. And you also, Jay, wanted to talk about demonstrations.
Yeah, just briefly. I joke about it, but I think there's a serious aspect to the fact that not a lot of people are showing up for these demonstrations. Trump had hoped, and I think he voiced that hope publicly, and certainly on Truth Social, that he would that people would show up for these and peacefully demonstrate. He stressed that this time, I posted yesterday on Facebook that he was suggesting that this was a plot. The reason people couldn't get in, that somehow they were being kept out of New York by the security or being kept away from the courthouse by security. There is a demonstration zone, I believe, where people can come and they can demonstrate. I said I think the more plausible reason is that a lot of people looked at the last time they showed up for a Trump demonstration and said, "Maybe, yeah, nah, I'm not going to participate in this." I do wonder if that's the case, and if it is, if we don't see any demonstrations of significance at the courthouse through the trial, I wonder what it says about the real support that Donald Trump has, whether it's support from a distance or it's as personal as so many people took it when they showed up on January 6th.
In New York City.
Yeah, that's true.
So if the court, but if the York trial were somewhere else.
If you can't get a demonstration going in New York City.
Sure.
So you're thinking that the January 6th convictions are actually having a deterrence effect?
Either the convictions or the association with the more, whatever the word you want to use, the more extreme folks who showed up for the people just don't want to be associated with.
That makes
me
happy, Jay.
That's a good thing.
I'd
be encouraged by that. But it would also suggest that maybe mainstream Republicans are starting to say, I don't want to get involved in the craziness.
I mean,
maybe.
Deterrence is a theory of criminal justice, right? We have these laws and we have punishment for the purpose of deterring others from doing the same thing. So if deterrence is working here to have avoid lawless protests, which that was on January 6th, that would be a great thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Who knows if people are going to show up or not? I think it depends on the twists and turns of the case and how the press goes and how Trump handles himself in the courtroom and outside. And I don't doubt that, he could turn on a dime and you could see a lot more receptivity in the Trump community, the Trump supporters community, and you could see protests.
Yep.
So it could happen.
And you could see very noisy protests at the end when the jury is deliberating, especially that they, let the jury hear you out on the street sort of protests. Who knows? We'll see.
Panel at WAMC.org to join the conversation. The Supreme Court of the United States is in session and hearing a lot of arguments on a lot of different things. We're going to discuss two of them this morning. I imagine more will come up as the weeks progress. Let's begin with ghost guns. This from the AP. The Supreme Court agreed on Monday to take up a Biden administration appeal over the regulation of difficult-to-trace ghost guns that had been struck down by lower courts. The justices, by a 5-4 vote, had previously intervened to keep the regulation in effect during the legal fight. Ghost guns, which, as a reminder, lack serial numbers, have been turning up at crime scenes with increasing regularity. The regulation, which took effect in 2022, changed the definition of a firearm under federal law to include unfinished parts, like the frame of a handgun or the receiver of a long gun, so they can be tracked more easily. These parts must be licensed and include serial numbers. Manufacturers must also run background checks before a sale, as they do with other commercially made firearms. The requirements apply regardless of how the firearm was made, meaning it includes ghost guns made from individual parts or kits or by 3D printers. The rule does not prohibit people from buying a kit or any type of firearm. It doesn't prohibit purchase. It just says they all need to be traceable. The Justice Department has told the court that local law enforcement agencies seized more than 19,000 ghost guns at crime scenes in 2021, more than tenfold increase in 5 years. U.S. District Judge Reed O'Connor in Fort Worth, Texas, struck down the rule last year, concluding that it exceeded the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives authority. O'Connor wrote that the definition of a firearm in federal law does not cover all parts of a gun. Congress could change the law, he wrote. A panel of the 5th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, made up of 3 appointees by then Donald Trump, largely upheld O'Connor's ruling, but it has gone to the Supreme Court. March.
Yeah, and the Supreme Court also allowed the ATF regulation to stand. That was a ruling last year, I think, while they're waiting to hear the case. And Coney Barrett and Roberts joined the liberal justices to allow the regulation to stand. That's was a little bit surprising to me. Mm-hmm. Knowing that there's 19,000, you know, ghost guns that were seized in 2021 really made me wonder, okay, what are the numbers today? Because if you go back prior to 2019, it was much less. So this is an area that's really growing. And I feel like the data is tremendously lagging in a frustrating way. You know, I was looking at some gun safety policy shops to see what they're saying about it. And they're still citing very old data. In 2019, 30% of the guns were recovered in California, you know, had no serial number. That's a big number, 30% of the guns recovered. But that's an old, that's old data, 2019. We're in 2024. What is it now?
Yeah.
Is it 70%? Is it 50%? So I just feel like maybe it's the posture of the case that, you know, this was litigated several years ago and now we're up on appeals. But I personally would like much fresher data on what the ghost gun environment really is like, because I think it's a lot worse than these numbers.
Having been in an arena of receiving information like that, what is the delay, do you think? Or why? How do we get the more recent numbers? How do we know? How do we find out what the numbers were for 2023, for instance?
I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, I would wonder, you know, you have these gun buyback programs. I mean, there was a picture actually in one of the articles I saw, and it was the Kings County, you know, which is New York, one of the boroughs, DA, during a gun buyback. That was an article on Fox News, and he was pointing to a ghost gun. It was a current buyback program that happened this year. So I don't know. They have the numbers. You know, the numbers are out there. But sometimes criminal justice lags in reporting. And I think it's because they want to make sure the numbers are correct.
Sure.
You know, there's a lot of vetting that happens, because once you put something out, then it's out there and it's really hard to retract it. You know, what if Kings County DA were to come out and say 50% of the guns seized are ghost guns, and then like the next buyback, it's only 10%, and it was just a fluke. You know what I'm saying? So I
sure.
think it takes time. But it's frustrating lag in this case. I'd really like to have more recent data, and I'm not sure why it's lagging. 5 years is a long time.
JP?
Knowing some people who have been in gun enthusiasts exploit loopholes in the law all the time. It's like a game in terms of, oh, we can buy this, or you have to go to this state to buy this, or, I got grandfathered in because I bought this before. Mm-hmm. And we've all heard that. And so they are trying to create this loophole with ghost guns where they will be untraceable. And I think what the law is saying is they want the parts of the ghost guns to have serial numbers and identification so it helps us track them. And why wouldn't we want to do that? Now, how the Supreme Court will decide on that, I don't know. Does anybody know indication of how the Supreme Court will decide on it? I didn't see that in the article that I read, but I would imagine that identifying parts, it's not like it's a part that could be a gun, it could be a hammer, it could be a plumbing device. No, they're all gun parts. And it seems totally reasonable to me that they should be identified as such and traceable as much as possible so that we can.
It does to me, too. But I have to say, the district court judge's argument, which is that, you know, Congress could add the word parts to the law, is persuasive to me. Like, that's not what the law says. Right. The law says guns. It doesn't say parts. And it's a broad interpretation of power. I wonder if the other cases pending on regulatory authority before the Supreme Court could influence this case, meaning like, you know, we're really looking at ATF's, ability to regulate within the sphere of their regulatory authority. And there's other cases right now pending that might jeopardize that. So,
Jay.
I was trying to find statistics on this because I use the statistics in an editorial just, I want to say, within the last couple of months. And there are more up to date than 2019. And the numbers are, the rise in numbers is really astounding, over time. That if you start around 2015 or so or thereabouts, the increase is exponential, maybe an exaggeration, but it is huge. I think it's an important distinction that the court probably is not going to care about, but maybe they will. Maybe they will, have a reasonable decision based on societal safety, as well as being the father of a lawyer, I've learned that you can argue anything. That's what you're trained to do as a lawyer. You can argue either side of the case, and the same thing applies for judges who decide things. It's not some pure Socratic thing that happens, or I don't know if Socratic's the right word. But anyway, it's not some pure thing that happens and each justice believes they have arrived at the perfect decision based on logic. They bring their own biases to it. So are they going to – which bias are they going to bring? And I suspect that the majority will bring a textual bias to it, and that what you're saying is right, ultimately, that if Congress wanted to do this, they would do it. They would say parts are also going to be included in this, and they wouldn't mind reining in the ATF. The other issue of this, I'm not sure who brought this suit. We're seeing kind of a bait and switch thing going on between the NRA and Gun Owners of America, where the NRA says one thing that appears reasonable, like on bump stocks, where they said, you know what, Congress, don't pass a law. We're going to say that the ATF should do the regulations on bump stocks. And I was waiting for the NRA, a few years later to come back and say, oh, no, the ATF can't do that. No, Gun Owners of America did. And it's, it's kind of like, well, one good cop, bad cop or something. What is the ultimate message when you're talking about, or what's the goal here when you're talking about traceable versus unavailable or available? The parts are all available. All they're saying, as JP pointed out, is make them traceable. And, that's a pro-law and order thing. That's a pro-cop thing. That's a pro-societal thing, that you want to be able to solve crimes, except when it comes to guns. I just don't understand what the gun rights activists are fighting for here. Unless it's, just the purity of the text of the law. And if that's the case, Congress needs to wake up and say, we're not going to make these guns unavailable. We're not coming for your guns, but we are going to insist that we're going to give law enforcement all the tools it needs within reason to fight crime.
Just shows you how important having a functioning Congress is. And I think this is, we're going in many, many years now of having totally dysfunctional Congress. Normal times, past practice, we would have had Congress step in and say, of course, we're going to regulate ghost guns, add parts and add ghost gun parts to the law, period. End of story.
And
both sides of the aisle.
This could not pass this Congress.
No way. This Congress can't pass anything.
I don't know how many Congresses it could pass, though. Gun rights, gun laws are just so toxic.
I mean, didn't we regulate automatic weapons during the Clinton
30
administration?
Years ago.
We did do
okay,
that.
30
yes,
years
so,
ago, 1994.
Right. A long time ago. Ghost guns are cheaper. They're $345 for an AR-15 in parts and $400 for a Glock. Sorry, I'm not trying to advertise ghost guns.
No, it's astounding. I mean, here we are in New York, you could not buy these things. But get it as a ghost gun, and you can have yourself a gun that you're not allowed to walk into a store and buy. Wow. I almost said a word I wasn't going to. I shouldn't.
Don't say a word you shouldn't.
I won't do that.
Please don't say a word you shouldn't. I want to talk about this part of the article from the New York Times and the case. In urging the Supreme Court to hear the administration's appeal in the case, which is Garland versus Vanderstock, I realize we hadn't said that until just now, Solicitor General, or at least I hadn't, Elizabeth B. Prologer said the appeals court ruling would produce a flood of untraceable ghost guns into our nation's communities, as we've just said. She asked the justices to consider an analogy. There's two analogies here. I do want to talk about them. If a state placed a tax on the sale of home goods such as tables, chairs, couches, and bookshelves, IKEA surely could not avoid that tax by claiming that it does not sell any of those items and instead sells furniture parts kits that must be assembled by the purchaser. So too with guns. An ordinary speaker of English would recognize that a company in the business of selling kits that can be assembled into firearms in minutes and that are designed, marketed, and used for that purpose is in the business of selling firearms. A Supreme Court brief from some of the challengers in an earlier phase of the case said that that comparison to IKEA and furniture, flat-packed table kits, is flawed. A better analogy, according to this challenger, would be a taco kit sold as a bundle by a grocery store that includes taco shell, seasoning packets, salsa, and other toppings, along with a slab of raw beef, which taco kits don't come with a slab, but that's fine. I would know.
That's why it's a bad example.
Both.
There's
bad
a lot
examples.
Of reasons. In addition to assembly, turning into one would require cutting or grinding and cooking the meat, and until that was done, it would be nonsensical to treat it as food and the equivalent of a taco.
I don't like either analogy. I think they're terrible. I think as soon as you're having the person having to assemble themselves, that's a different act. And as JP said earlier, you know, there's this, you know, effort to kind of, quote, get around the rules. And we see that in tax law all the time. And we condone it and we allow it and we encourage it, actually. So I think the tax law arguments are specious here. You know, if you're trying to get around it, it may be legitimate.
I think, yeah, and also just in terms of the analysis of the analogies, which I realize is not what we're necessarily here for, a taco kit is food, right? Like, it's not food yet. I think your mic is off, Jay. I know, but we don't need to continue down that path. I just was, you know.
The analogies made me more confused.
Sure. Because I think, yeah, you're assembling a taco, which is food. You're assembling furniture from pieces, which is furniture. You're assembling guns from pieces, which are guns. Kits
but
are
the act of assembling it itself. It means it's a different product. You're actually getting your purchase is a different product. You know, there is a difference between getting a fully made table and getting an IKEA table that you're gonna have to spend an hour or two putting together. So, I think it's a totally different example. Yeah.
Panel at WAMC.org. To join the conversation, I am checking the inbox now to see if we have any comments on this. We don't, but we do have this letter. Listening to the panel today, the tone, the articulation of concept, and the quality of disagreement, it was all somehow so comforting to hear. Each person involved deserves a thank you for your contribution. You guys got a thank you
so
for your
sweet.
Participation
oh,
from
I thank
Kathy.
That,
thank you.
I thank them for that letter. Thank you.
It's nice. It's nice to get a compliment once in a while, right? Panel at WAMC.org to join the conversation. I want to begin a new topic, but we only have... I'll set it up, and then we'll discuss it when we come back. So... let's talk about another SCOTUS case. This is about unhoused persons in the country, but specifically Oregon. Supreme Court justices expressed a concern on Monday about punishing unhoused people for sleeping outside when they have nowhere else to go, while also struggling with how to ensure local and state leaders have flexibility to deal with the growing number of unhoused individuals nationwide. This text from the Washington Post. The court's review of a set of Oregon anti-camping laws could lead to the most significant ruling on the rights of the unhoused in decades, with potentially sweeping implications for state capitals and city streets. Throughout a more than two-hour argument, the justices, plural, seemed to divide along ideological lines, with conservatives who make up the court's majority suggesting that the elected officials and lawmakers, not judges, should be setting local rules for dealing with unhoused people. Chief Justice John G. Roberts Jr. asked the Biden administration's lawyer, "Why do you think these nine people are the best people to judge and weigh those policy judgments?" Justice Brett Kavanaugh also expressed concern about the federal court's micromanaging homelessness policy. The court's three liberal justices aggressively questioned the law for the city of Grants Pass, Oregon, criticizing its laws for seeming to criminalize the most basic of human needs. Justice Sotomayor asked where people are supposed to sleep in a city that lacks sufficient shelter and beds. The city's lawyers defend the law and emphasize the harm that can come from people living on streets and in parks. So Supreme Court hearing a case about unhoused, about the management and compassion, et cetera, to be displayed legally to unhoused citizens, and we will talk about it when we return. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel. I'm Sarah LaDuke in for Joe Donahue this morning. Our music is from Allison Russell. She's playing a show in Kingston on May 24th. You can visit opositivefestival.org to learn more about that. Join the conversation in this last segment of the show for this morning by emailing panel@wamc.org. I am here with March Gallagher, Jay Jochnowitz, and JP Miller. And before the BBC, I set up the story on the Supreme Court hearing a case on unhoused citizens and their treatment in Oregon. Who would like to begin?
City of Grants Pass versus Johnson is the case, if
Thank
anybody's
you.
Wondering. And basically it's an anti-camping law in City of Grants Pass, and three, you know, unhoused individuals sued over it. you know, Grants Pass isn't the only place seeking clarification. And even Gavin Newsom, the governor of California, submitted a brief saying, you know, we need guidance on our ability to take action because it's such a dire circumstance with so many people living outside. I think we read that there were 600,000 homeless people in America. I think that is way under the true number. Yeah. That does not seem like a real number to me at all.
And it's more than ever, and will continue. There's no end in sight of the number going up. It continues to rise.
Justice Elena Kagan said sleeping is a biological necessity. That really rang true to me. You know, where are people supposed to go? What are they supposed to do if they don't have somewhere to be? And basically you're seeing communities like Grants Pass say, go somewhere else. Leave here and go somewhere else, you know, become a roving situation where people have nowhere to be. And that's the argument against that legislation in the city of Grants Pass, which is like, you don't have the right to tell people they can't be in your city whatsoever. But I have to say, after reading some of the comments of the justices and the questions, I don't think this case is going to find for the unhoused individuals. I think the majority of the court is going to come down saying city of Grants Pass is fine and doing what they're doing. And that's a terrible, terrible state of affairs, because we have a huge problem in this country with people who cannot afford to find a place to live. And it's a matter of severe inequity. And we're not solving the problem. And, you know, ruling out the ability of unhoused individuals to set up camp or to sleep on a park bench is not going to solve the problem.
I heard a story on Morning Edition from NPR yesterday morning about this case. And one of the concerns of unhoused citizens and their advocates, of course, is that it can be harder for them to find housing in the future if they receive some kind of conviction for trespassing, or if they're fined. Obviously, they're ultimately in a precarious financial situation, and adding to fines to their debt isn't beneficial.
And this Grants Pass rule, their local law, has a $75 to a $295 fine associated with a violation.
So where do we go with that? I mean, you know, are we headed for debtors' prisons, essentially, on this, where you don't pay your fine, and jail is an option in this case. And I could, you know, jail is not a pleasant place. And I don't think anybody eagerly says, there's an answer to my homeless problem. I'll get convicted of something and end up in jail, or I'll get charged with something. I don't think anybody really likes to do that or feels it's a good option. But there's some, you know, again, this is such a complicated issue, because homelessness and, you know, the analogy I've at least a similar problem. That I look at with this is the issue of forced medication. So and I can't remember the name of the law in New York that's so controversial about this in the mental health community, where people who represent threats to themselves or threats to the public can come under court order to you have a choice. You can be institutionalized or jailed, or you can take your medication.
A mental hygiene law?
Mental hygiene law, yeah. And it's named for somebody, though. I want to say Suzanne's law, but I could be wrong.
Let me see if I can find that for you.
It's a law I agree with. I mean, you know,
Kendra's law.
And I think that was about pushing somebody off she was pushed off a subway station, a subway platform. Given the choice between people taking their medication and being under control and being able to function in society, or pushing people off a subway platform, I would say let's err on the side of public safety and maximum rights. And you know, maybe people don't like taking medication because of what it does to their, you know, sense of self, their creativity, any number of things. But, you know, there are some trade-offs. And I think the same thing applies, in a sense, to homelessness, that, you know, I sympathize with Grants Pass and all, any other municipality that does not want people sleeping in their streets, because we don't want to be confronted with homelessness. We don't want to be confronted with what leads a person to just lie down in a street and or in a doorway. And it's heartbreaking. And I don't think society wants to face it, and we need to face it. I disagree with you, though. I think the court is going to say, if you don't come up with a solution, you can't tell people they can't stay in your town. and they can't lie down on a park bench or whatever. I think they're going to, I'd like to think there's going to be a wise and compassionate decision here, as much as this court can be wise and compassionate.
I think that the homeless issue is less about homelessness. It's more about the density of having a tent city or having vast, you know, what you would call a ghetto of people setting up tents and saying, well, this is compassionate. We're going to let them live like this. And the question, of course, as you both say, is, well, where do they go if they can't be here? You also have to look at the rights of people that have, you know, this is my city, I live here, and we shouldn't have to go outside when we walk our kids to school and have syringes all over the streets. Mm-hmm. And homeless people acting, you know, not acting appropriately in front of children, which happens a lot of times when people in bad neighborhoods bring their kids to school, or tough neighborhoods bring their kids to school, and there's a big homeless problem. It is obviously a complex issue, because what do you do with people, and where do you force them to go, or where do you offer them to go? And I have no idea how the Supreme Court will decide on it.
We'll take a bet. I think that the elected officials who are, you know, creating laws around where you can be, it's less about seeing people, and it's, you know, they're couch it in health and safety terms, right? It's a concern for health and safety. It's not sanitary. You know, diseases can spread. It's not safe. So that's kind of the posture of a lot of these regulations of homeless folks homeless encampments that you see pop up. It's couched as health and safety, and health and safety is a huge issue here. It's not a place to be with dignity, and it's not the safest place even for, you know, the unhoused individuals themselves. So it's a lot of policy issues wrapped up in one thing here. Yeah.
Jade writes into panel at WAMC.org and says, I'm reading John Steinbeck's Americans in America. He observes the issue of poor families from Oklahoma living in tents and starving to death when the agricultural season ends. He discusses the banks, big business, and sheriffs attempting to get rid of these people after their work is done. The book was published in 1938. So, making a point, it's, of course, not a new problem. Joe writes in and says, bring back debtor's prison and jail Trump when he can't pay his fines or bail bond. We heard, I thought you guys were going to giggle at that. But you don't have to.
I was still stuck on the last comment.
Okay.
Because it's not a new problem, but I think we did see a very, very, very low level of homelessness for a period of time. And it is feeling more like we're going to be seeing Hooverville type situations. And that is relatively new over the last 20 years. So it's a problem that ebbs and flows. I think the historical perspective is really important. We had a situation like this during the Great Depression, and we did something about it called the New Deal. So what are we doing now?
We need the old New Deal. Ruth says, dear panel, we are a rich country. There's no excuse for not providing safe, decent housing for everyone, and I mean everyone. Yes, consider public health and safety both. Both can only be enhanced by appropriate housing. Jonathan writes in and says, homelessness is not a mental health problem or a drug problem. It's a housing problem. There's not enough housing. We as a society are not willing to build housing, which we need for our people.
I'd like to see statistics to back that up, though. I would love to see an analysis, you know, a good analysis of, you know, a sample homeless population or even a national homeless population, as much as we can get at, to see how much of an intersection there is with mental illness
and
homelessness.
Sure.
Well,
it's not a single circle Venn diagram, yeah. But there is, of course, overlap, I think, Jonathan.
But also,
the lack of housing
availability makes those people who are already at risk in more jeopardy for becoming homeless. So to say, like, oh, well, a large percentage of the homeless population has a mental illness, when, by the way, I'm sure if I was living, you know, behind the supermarket, I would have a mental health problem myself developed just from that experience. But
sure.
Also, as you see these prices rise, as you see availability go down, then people who are already at risk, who are already in jeopardy, are those people that are on the edge and that are forced out first. So it's not an easy way to identify, like, who who has the root of the problem founded in mental health or addiction versus who would have been fine if housing availability was there. So, yeah, it's a lot of issues wrapped up in one.
It does, though, speak to what you do to solve the problem. So what type of housing you build, whether it's going to be, I think they call
supportive.
It supportive housing.
I agree with that.
And where it's going to be. Is it going to be near places where there are services? And then, you know, what do you do? Because usually that's an urban area, and then you get into the whole issue of, you know, city saying, you know, we have enough of an expense dealing with all the things we're dealing with now. Now you want us to build more homeless housing and supportive housing and institutions and all
no,
of that.
I just well, want you to get rid of Airbnb. And
there you go.
well, there's that.
And also you go to NYCHA housing in New York City, and when former Governor Cuomo went there, he said, you know, they're deplorable conditions. He'd never seen such deplorable conditions, and nothing has changed since he went there. And you talk about, okay, well, we're going to build housing in these communities, or we're going to bring migrants into these communities. All of those politicians that are for that, all of a sudden they say, well, we want to do it, but not quite in our neighborhood. Our neighborhood is not conducive to that.
Right.
Ruth writes in and says, a question, is it really important to call people who have no place to live unhoused? Doesn't homeless convey their situation perfectly? Sometimes we get bogged down in words that do nothing to make the issue better. And I would like to say, I don't think replacing the word is bogging the conversation down. I push back gently on that.
Although we did notice, and we observed this on the break sort of before we started this morning, that the article bounces back and forth. The New York Times themselves seems to vacillate between the two terms. And I think, you know, people are trying to figure out the right way to talk about it. I think the main point is that we're talking about people. We're talking about human beings.
Right.
And that's why people go to the word unhoused, is to identify the humanity of the people involved.
Right. They're not to identify them as a subset of humanity that is homeless, puts them in a box that
hold signs saying homeless and hungry. They don't ever say unhoused.
100%. I agree with that. Yeah. That's true. It's easier to understand. Yeah. And you can still acknowledge somebody's humanity and use the word homeless, I believe.
Yeah. I do think these terms of art polarize the discussion because they invite people who are already skeptical or just want to be skeptical.
Right. It's pushing back like, you know, against kinda, PC like always. Yeah. Which is, you know, it's part of the conversation a lot of the time. That is, let's see, yeah, okay. We're out of time for today.
Oh.
But I appreciate all of you very much for being here. I was joined by Ulster County Comptroller and former president and CEO of the Community Foundations of the Hudson Valley, Marge Gallagher, semi-retired editor-at-large, columnist and editorial writer for the Times Union, Jay Jochnowitz, and the Empire Reports, J.P. Miller. Thank you all, as always, for being here. We'll see you again soon.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks.
The panel will be posted later at wamc.org, and the Congressional Corner is next. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.